Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and hello everybody to the seventh and last edition of our little podcast Beyond Business here at the ITB Berlin Congress. And today it's the last day on ITB. We are already in the afternoon of the last day and the ITB convention. And during the last 3 days, we heard a lot of talking, tons of talking about travel management, travel digitalization, AI, profits, optimization, travel, customer habits, business models, everything. So, but now I'm very glad to have somebody who's not talking about traveling. He's actually a traveler, and we could say he's a real traveler. Welcome, Mr. Thor Pedersen from Denmark.
Thank you.
Thor Pedersen is somebody who has traveled all countries of this planet within 10 years.
Yes.
Which is crazy enough, but he did it without using a plane.
Yes.
Welcome here on our podcast. So, of course, the first question, how do you come up with such a crazy idea, traveling all planets without a plane?
Yes. Well, the short answer is I was very crazy, and that was kind of enough. But in a little bit of an extension, I received an email from my father. I followed a link, and I found out that no one in history had gone to every country in the world completely without flying. And that was so significant for a 34-year-old version of me back in 2013 that I just had to do it.
Okay. And you completed it 1 year ago or 2 years ago? Or
a couple of years ago, yes, in July 2023.
Since you are back and you're maybe back to a more normal life or kind of an ordinary life now? Or
a little bit of both. You know, so I have a daughter now and she's 1 year and 3 months. So I'm changing diapers and bringing her to daycare. And, you know, I'm sleeping in the same bed as my wife and waking up next to my wife. So in that sense, it's normal.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's not normal because I'm getting invited to crazy places around the world and I'm asked to go and speak different places. I have all sorts of activities I never dreamt about I would ever have in my life because of what I did.
What are the most common questions people asking you when they hear about your story? What's the most asked question you get from people hear from your experience?
I get a range of questions. So some people are curious about how I'm coping mentally, if I find it easy to return back to a normal life, or if I'm still looking out the window and looking at the horizon. Some people, they want to know how I did it financially. Some people are asking what's my favorite country, and some people ask me if I was in danger. There are different questions from different people.
Do you think that you are projecting a lot, or other people projecting a lot of on you, that it raises a lot of fantasies and people would think, oh, I also would love to do that? Or is it something like that?
I find that people fall into two groups. One side would be people who think what I did was absolutely amazing and incredible, and they're very curious about the achievement. And the other group would be people who sort of say, okay, I could do that if I didn't have a wife and child. If I wanted to do this, I could do it as well. He just went traveling for almost 10 years, complete freedom. And the reality is the project was something completely different from ordinary travel and tourism, but it's difficult for people to relate to it.
So you did a lot of planning in advance?
Yes. Yes. I did quite a lot of planning in advance and then a lot of work on the way as well. I planned out the route in advance. So I knew that the first country after Denmark would be Germany, and then I'd go Netherlands and continue to Belgium and Luxembourg and so on. I knew that I would start in Europe and that I would finish off in the Pacific. There were some strategic ideas behind how the route needed to look like. I knew that I was traveling as a goodwill ambassador of the Danish Red Cross. I was partnered with the Red Cross and I met with the Red Cross and Red Crescent globally, promoting humanitarian work. So this was a part of it. And I had some idea about how I would be sharing the journey on social media when I left home, but this gradually changed and developed to more platforms than what I started out with.
You mentioned that you are a member of an adventurer club, which seems to be a very exclusive club. What kind of club is it and how do you qualify for that? What's the qualifications to become a member of that kind of club?
So I think the adventurers club in Denmark is the answer to the explorers club in New York, maybe. So in Denmark, it's perhaps the most exclusive club we have in Denmark. It's by invitation only. And the process is very, very long and difficult. There are 119 members today, and there have been less than 500 members since it was formed in 1938. So it's a group. We have a nice big round table, and we meet up every Tuesday. And we have the only astronaut from Denmark is a member of the club. We have these long-distance cyclists that go across Pakistan and Afghanistan and India. We have glaciologists. We have a lot of people that are interested in the poles of this planet and exploring undiscovered territory. Now that the snow and ice is melting, they will be the first to arrive on site and see what they can find. It's a big mix. We have, of course, war correspondents. These are highly adventurous people as well who have been in many interesting parts of the world where things have been happening. It's a big mix of very interesting characters.
And it's basically a club for socializing and for exchange, right?
It is, yes. It's a place where like-minded people can come together and exchange ideas and get inspired and inspire each other. It's a network group as well.
I would like to talk about the experience of traveling, and I would like to know a little bit about the hardships of traveling, but not the usual stuff like language problems, or you have people who want to rip you off, or some silly bureaucrat who gives you a hard time. I would rather like to know more about the emotional stuffs.
Right.
Things which might be stressful or which might be really testing for your inner constitution. Like, for example, I mean, you've been on the road mostly, or on the ship or whatever, but not on the plane, but you've been traveling 10 years, which is an amazing long time. And what do you think? What about boredom? Does this appear as boredom a problem?
No, boredom is certainly not a problem. Or maybe actually a little bit when it gets easy. So if you've been traveling in some really complicated parts of the world where paperwork, bureaucracy and logistics takes up a lot of time and gets you frustrated, and you suddenly go somewhere super easy, then a little bit of boredom might enter. But no, generally, it's an incredible workload just securing all the tickets and the paperwork and moving forward. And of course, you spend a lot of time in transportation. In my case, I was spending a lot of time meeting with the Red Cross and humanitarian organizations promoting this. Social media, in my case, also promoting every country in the world in a positive sense. So there wasn't really room for boredom. And then I was in a long distance relationship with the woman I love. She was at home when I left, and fortunately she was there when I came back as well. We got engaged and married 2 times while I was traveling, and married a 3rd time when I came back home. But no, so to touch upon one of the aspects of doing it for so long, I have met a tremendous amount of travelers as I was going through the world. I was often staying at hostels, and sometimes I go through popular countries where you see a lot of backpackers and so on. And I would often meet people who were traveling for 3 months, 4 months, or 6 months. And it's quite common, actually. Some people are traveling for a year. But in each case, if it's 6 months or 1 year, when I meet them at the end of these periods, they're ready to go home. They have experienced enough for now. They need to go home and recharge and then go out and visit the world again at some other point. To see people travel continuously for 2 years is unheard of.
It's rare. Most people do 1 year and then...
It's like finding a unicorn. It just doesn't really happen. And if they're traveling for 2 years, then it's because they stopped somewhere for maybe 3 months or 4 months working at a farm or working at a hostel somewhere or something like this, but not constantly moving with a backpack. It really just doesn't happen. And my breaking point was about 2 years mentally. And then I thought the entire project would take 4 years or less, and it ended up taking almost 10. So the further I got into it, the harder it got for several reasons. There were 3 ground rules for the project. One was I couldn't fly at any point for any reason whatsoever. Another one was it had to be minimum 24 hours in every country. And the 3rd one, which made it really hard, was that I could not return home until I got to the last country or if I quit the project. So the further I got, it got harder and harder, like building a card house or a house of cards. That when you put down the 1st 2 cards, it doesn't matter if they fall. There's no investment. You just put them again. And you build 1 layer and the next layer. And when you get to the top cards, your hands are shaking. And if it falls down, you have to start from the beginning again. So the element of stress with having traveled for 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, or just missing 10 countries, 5 countries, if something goes wrong.
Because you were tempted to give up.
I was tempted to give up. This was one element. And then you have this discussion with a future version of yourself where you say, okay, the person I am today, right now, I want to give up. I don't see any value in this. But then what happens when I go home? Will 3 months pass and then I start questioning, why did I give up? Was it really so hard? So this discussion exists. But there's also, the longer it takes, there's a risk that someone that you love back home falls ill, gets hit by a car, or maybe someone old goes to the hospital. And then you have to choose between if you're going to finalize the goal you set out on years before, or if you're going to return home to be with the one you care about. Another issue, of course, was that the woman that I married, I was 34 when I left and I came back when I was 44. Yeah. You can imagine my wife, she aged at the same rate.
So it was like a distanced relationship.
She would come and visit on and off. She came to visit 27 times. But the point is that if she got pregnant 5 years before I come home, then I come home to a five-year-old child. And this was not acceptable to her.
Yeah.
We had to wait for the entire project to finish. Then maybe it's too late to start a family.
I have to look at my list of stressful emotions. So, I mean, loneliness was probably not a problem, I guess, because you were in a relation. And
so loneliness can be in different ways. I was never socially lonely. I was constantly near some people. I was in a completely packed bus or at a hostel or at someone's family. But there is loneliness that people can relate to going to a party and the room is full of people. And for some reason, you feel completely alone at the party. And that's the loneliness that I was experiencing often. I was the only one that knew the story. Anyone who would see me with my hat and my beard and my backpack and say, okay, he's just a tourist, he's just a traveler. But reality was that I hadn't been home for many years, that I had gone over and above to accomplish what I did. Three of the ships I traveled on were at the bottom of the sea. I had cerebral malaria. I was held at gunpoint. All of this stuff before I come and meet with people. And I was the only one carrying this story. So I felt alone in that people could not relate to me.
I mean, going back to the other side of the spectrum of emotion, besides seeing your girlfriend or your wife during these 10 years, what are the most joyful experience or the most joyful moments you had where you felt you were really happy or blissful? Or
it's going to sound very strange, but because this was a project which was based on achievement, and each new country I reached was achievement, and reaching the final country would obviously be the ultimate achievement within it. There was great joy in getting a difficult visa or crossing a border or making this progress, coming on board a ship when I knew this was very difficult or I'd been working on it for a long time.
So bureaucrats can create such a joy by giving a visa, right?
Well, you know, so
such a big difference.
Essentially reaching a goal that this is a project with all the countries in the world, and every country was sort of like a small goal within. So there was definitely joy in that. There was a lot of joy in conversations with people all around the world. And a lot of these conversations were very rich. Some of these conversations would go for many hours, and sometimes I wouldn't get enough sleep because it just goes through the night. So these conversations were very powerful and they gave me immense joy. Every time my wife came to visit me, there was a lot of happiness within that. When we got engaged and when we got married, there was happiness in that. A few times I reached a country where I was just taken back on how beautiful it all was to me. And, you know, we see beauty in different ways. But so to my eyes, I just felt like, wow, this is a completely different level of beauty in this country. And that would also fill my heart with happiness.
How did you see the world and mankind 10 years ago before you started? And how do you see the world and mankind today? What's the difference in viewing at life and world? And we're all in.
Yeah, I love that question. So I know for a fact that when I left on the 10th of October, 2013, we had designed a project where the motto was, a stranger is a friend you've never met before. And we stuck with that. I had some friends help me in the beginning. So the reason we took that is because it sounded like this might be right, but I didn't know that this was right. And at the point when I came back home, I knew for a fact that this is true. I came home and I looked at the world map and I realized that I had not been to a single country in the world where I had not met someone who helped or supported me in one way or the other, showed me kindness in one way or the other. And then I came to look at that as a reversed lottery, where in a normal lottery, you know you're going to lose. The chances are completely against you. There's a chance to win, but you expect to lose. And with me, when I look at the world and I think of people, I expect to win all around the world.
So would you say you have more confidence in the world than you had 10 years ago because so many friendly, helpful people everywhere?
Well, so the unfortunate, well, this can quickly get political, yes? But the unfortunate element...
We will not get into politics.
No. But so the unfortunate element with people is that a lot of the kind people, they have no real power. So you play football with children, you're invited for a meal, you go for a walk with a nice man somewhere, you go into the forest and you're guided and you see beautiful animals and you have these experiences. And these people, they complain about the same things that we do, that there is evil in the world and there's nothing they can really do about that. So if you say, what's the state of the world? Do we have confidence in the world? It's difficult because as a goodwill ambassador of the Danish Red Cross, I was plugged in to the humanitarian work around the world. And the reality of the Red Cross is that the Red Cross is only needed because things are not the way they're supposed to be. The Red Cross is there to do humanitarian work. So I was very aware of all the humanitarian work there is in the world. And my project on its own was to promote every country in the world in a positive way, looking for the good things. So people and food and culture and history and sites and so on. So there was this balance between the yin yang of it. I have a lot of confidence in people and in the world in general, and I have less confidence in the more negative aspects of our world.
Three simple advices for the global traveler. What would you give?
Well, a very simple one would be try to learn a little bit of the local language and then use it every chance you get. It brings so much joy to people generally when they can see that you're trying. And don't be afraid, just try to pronounce it the best way you can and then laugh with people, you know. So that would be one advice. Another advice would be to look at yourself as an ambassador. You are going to a village you've never been before. You're going to a country you've never been before. The people you meet, maybe they never met anyone from your country. So make a really good impression so that when they think about your country, they think about something good. Be at your best behavior. Remember that you are a guest. And then the third thing would be to get into conversations as much as possible and forget your phone a little bit, you know, put it in your pocket or
that
put it off.
That may be important in these days, right? Forgetting the phone?
Well, the phone is an important tool in general when you're traveling. It's very useful for many things, but it can get in the way of having real meaningful experiences. So sometimes put it away or leave it behind.
I remember writing on a wall in a hostel in Amsterdam, which I saw several years ago, and it said, a true traveler has seen more than he can remember.
Hmm.
Memory is a tricky subject sometimes. Are you in control of all your memories during these 10 years? Do you kept the protocol or you had a diary or what is it in your brain?
I wrote a blog almost on a weekly basis throughout all of this. So a lot of what I was supposed to remember is in this blog. Reality is that I remember different things on different days. Sometimes I smell something or I see something and I remember something in Angola or something in Chile or something in Cyprus. Once in a while, someone will contact me on social media and say, do you remember me? And I'll look at the name and look at the photo. And then 2 minutes later, I get a photo where there's a picture of me with my arm around this person. So I know I met this person and now I need to find the context.
I mean, your address book must be pretty big, right?
My address book is quite impressive. I have kings and queens in my address book at this point. The secretary generals of the Red Cross globally and many interesting people.
Yeah. So you need a secretary to manage that all, right? You can't do that by yourself.
Yes.
I'm tempted to ask what would be your favorite country, but I think this might be an unfair question, right? Because
it is.
There's uniqueness in every country and exposing one country might be not too fair to all the other countries, right? If you would say something, you can say something.
Oh, I get this question quite often. So I guess so.
But
and it's a really valid question. And I have a Norwegian friend who's been to every country 2 times. And he says that this question is often in relation to not the one who's getting asked the question, but the one who's asking, because the one who's asking is looking for a tip to go travel.
I will ask that differently, and that will be our last question. I mean, if you would be a space traveler through technology and you meet an alien and you find the same language and the alien would say, oh, I'm a tourist through space and I'm going to visit the Earth, but I have very limited time. and I can only visit one country on this strange planet Earth, which country would you recommend? Because you're a human.
I say, come to Denmark.
I love that answer. It's perfect. Mr. Thor Pedersen, there was such a pleasure having you here on the last day of ITB. I liked the last answer. It was perfect. Thank you very much.
The pleasure was very much mine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.